Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out. Oh, hey, Chuck.
Hey, Chris.
I've been thinking about this patient I have with carpal tunnel. Well, I think it's carpal tunnel. What do you think? 45-year-old woman, 9 months of symptoms. It's mainly in her thumb and index, but sometimes it's her whole hand. Wakes her up at night, has to shake out her hand. Symptoms are starting to spill into the daytime. She's really frustrated because she can't sleep.
And, well, it does sound like carpal tunnel. What has she done so far? Anything to evaluate it or to treat it? Has she done therapy, taken any medicines?
Hasn't taken any medicines, hasn't gone to therapy. She bought a brace at a drugstore that said it was for carpal tunnel, but she doesn't wear it all the time. She's not sure when she's supposed to wear it. Sometimes she wears it at night, hasn't noticed a difference, but hasn't consistently worn it.
Great. I would say, you know, for this patient, and gosh, it sure sounds like carpal tunnel, I still like to be systematic and not jump the gun and just make an assumption. It's really easy for you and I to say, oh, this is carpal tunnel, and skip three steps. And most of the time, we'll be fine with that. But I think occasionally we could be burned. So if you want, we can just talk through this like we might talk through a patient that is less obvious.
Sure. So what do you think are, first, let's start with the classic symptoms or the classic history that a patient with carpal tunnel will give you.
I would say one easy answer is the night awakenings. And that's a good symptom for two reasons. One, it helps with the diagnosis, and two, if the patient ultimately comes to treatment, they're going to be happy with treatment.
Oh, they love it. They love it. If you catch them at that sweet spot where they have nocturnal symptoms more than anything else, treating that patient will lead to a very happy clinic visit.
Yeah, absolutely. The other symptoms that I look at, you know, early symptoms are things like intermittent numbness and tingling. During the day, I always ask about driving, talking on the phone, weird activities like yoga or things that put your wrist in different
yoga
positions.
Yoga is not weird, Chuck.
Yoga is weird for me. I've tried yoga, including hot yoga, and let's just say I'm too old.
I never had taken that step, but I think yoga is good for you, and I don't think it's weird. And a lot of our patients do yoga, so it's good to know the parlance.
It does put your wrist in unusual positions.
Wrist extension is not unusual.
But it could be symptomatic.
Okay, fine.
Give me that one.
Okay, fine. Let's get back on track.
All right. So other things, you know, neck pain is relevant, or symptoms radiating from the neck down.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, you want to rule out cubital tunnel. You can ask a few questions. Certainly, it could be part of your exam. So to summarize, I would say night awakenings, intermittent numbness or tingling, and I like to look at classic distribution. So it makes it way easier if it's radial side of the hand, thumb index and long finger. If it's the whole hand, certainly doesn't rule out carpal tunnel, but makes it a little less certain that that's the diagnosis.
Yeah, and I think there is some reasonable literature looking at the presentation of patients with carpal tunnel versus cubital tunnel versus both and how they present, and it can be all over the map. Clearly, it's a lot easier to work from if they tell you the radial-sided fingers, but you know, there are those that believe that even treating a carpal tunnel, say you get to the step of carpal tunnel release, that is your, you know, potential indirect decompression of Guillain's canal as well.
So I did my training with Peter Stern, and he pounded into my head the associated conditions with carpal tunnel, which are always nice to know. I'm not sure they really affect my treatment. What are the things you think about?
You know, it was pounded into my head by Richard Gelderman to think about diabetes and thyroid conditions in particular. And then there's some newer literature showing things like amyloidosis, and that's something that we should keep in mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know you're more of a nerve nerd than I am, and so you always think about plexus and double crush syndrome. Is that fair?
I do. You know, I think that it kind of depends on the intricacies of the presentation, and if it is a very classic case, I'm thinking less of things like the plexus and thoracic outlet and double crush, but always at the back of my mind because I don't want to miss that, because certainly it has implications on how you counsel the patient, although it may not ultimately change what you do right away. I'd rather treat the carpal tunnel syndrome first before doing anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right, because you want to do something that's super easy if it happens to be both. I agree.
What are some of the not-so-classic presentations you've seen for carpal tunnel syndrome?
Yeah, you know, I have a younger population, and the adolescent population is really unusual, but in those patients especially, sometimes we see weird things. The whole hand, I should be clear, symptoms involving the whole hand. And I will say also, when pain is the primary complaint, it gives me pause. Just like Night Awakenings give me, you know, give me great joy because I know I can help that. Pain's always a little weird. And certainly that can be the primary symptom. But whole hand pain, dorsal hand pain I've seen before. Patients that say symptoms radiate proximally rather than distally, that's not that weird, but I hear that one and it gives me pause.
That one makes me think of double crush. You know, I think that that's been described. I believe Lee Osterman wrote a bit about that, as well as Lee Dellen, with proximally radiating symptoms, saying, hey, you should really think about a more proximal site of compression. So circling back to your patient with pain and that more atypical presentation, do you see a role for injections diagnostically or potentially with a steroid in there?
Yeah, I use injections, I guess, in a couple of scenarios. With a classic patient, I might offer an injection, but it is something that I offer with not reluctance, but I try to give good information. Because my personal belief is it is not a particularly long-lasting option. So if a patient needs temporary improvement or if we need help with diagnosis, then steroid injections are for me, but not my routine. For patients with atypical symptoms, and whether that's pain or pain with negative nerve studies or something just isn't right, before I jump to surgery, I will use the steroid injection as a diagnostic test. And then finally, in the set of recurrence, if I need to confirm a diagnosis, I really like steroid injections. I'm guessing you use them at least some as well?
I do. I'm as selective as you are with that. I also always have in the back of my mind the picture I saw in a textbook of the size of a 21-gauge needle relative to the median nerve and its fascicles, and that always gives me pause. So clearly, you know, when you're doing the injection, you want to angle yourself away from the nerve, but I don't think nerves like steroid very much, you know, so that's something to consider. But they are a very powerful tool for diagnosis in the patients with an atypical presentation.
All right, let's talk technical. Since we're on injections, let's just talk about how you do them, what size needle, what type of steroid you use, and exactly how you give the injection, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I use Depomedrol as part of my mixture, and it's mixed with lidocaine, 1% plain, 1:1. That's our standard injection that I use in my clinic for basically every condition, and that just facilitates the process of giving injections. Yeah, I know there is some discussion about the type of steroid that could be used, and we'll leave that open for debate. In terms of the positioning of the injection, I have the patient flex the wrist and oppose the thumb to the small finger. It's nice if there's a palmaris longus. If not, I work my way just ulnar to the midline, and I'm just proximal to the wrist crease. And warn the patient, we know that injecting too close to the nerve, or God forbid, into the nerve, is certainly bad for it. So I tell the patient that they're going to feel some fullness, but I want them to tell me if they feel any sort of electrical type shooting or sensation. So with the wrist in a neutral position and flat on a surface, I'll place the needle in, and then I'll angle facing or heading slightly distal and heading slightly radial, but clearly on the ulnar side of the midline. And after you poke through that volar and brachial fascia, you don't need to go very far. You certainly want to make sure you're not injecting into the flexor tendons nor into the nerve.
Perfect. That's a great description. That's very similar to what I do.
It's because you trained me.
Perfect. You do it right. I think that of all the injections I give, this is the least painful. I also think I do believe one can feel the needle going through the transverse carpal ligament a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And for me, as soon as I'm just poking through, that's when I give the injection. I also warn patients about an electrical shock going distally. And if they tell me that, I pull the needle back slightly and redirect more ulnarly. And knock on wood, I've never known of any injection into the nerve or permanent issues or anything like that. So I recognize the concern with Depomedrol versus other types of steroids, but I've been happy with it personally.
So let's backpedal back to the examination. So you think in your head you're heading towards a carpal tunnel. Tell me how you systematically work through that exam.
Right. Thank you. So, you know, I always examine both upper extremities. I start with a very simplistic range of motion assessment, which takes, you know, 5 seconds for elbows, forearms, wrists, and hands. I make sure of full flexion and extension of the fingers. And, you know, while it's almost always normal, occasionally you pick up something that's relevant. I then tend to assess strength next before I start irritating nerves. And so I do tend to focus that part. I don't check deltoid strength or things like that if I'm worried about a focal problem distally. But I would, I tend to check abductor pollicis brevis and first dorsal interosseous and FDP to index and small in every patient. I do that, as I have been taught, and I think APB is the most relevant for this discussion, 95%+ of the time it's innervated solely by the median nerve, recurrent branch. I have the patient put the hand flat on the table, point the thumb towards the ceiling, I palpate the muscle, and I resist the patient keeping it straight up, and I try to push it down. Towards the table. And I like that way of testing muscle strength. Is that what you do, or what do you test muscle-wise?
So I test the same muscles. I look for FPL as well, because I think that's a nice way. Sometimes you get some funny shared innervation or shared muscle bellies to the index FDP. And I'll check the FPL like we talked about in the prior episode with the wrist flex. I do want to try and unlock some of that weakness. And your point about checking both sides is valuable, because if you do find some subtle weakness, you want to show, if you can, how it's different compared to the opposite side. And in terms of checking the APB, I agree entirely, and it's important to push reasonably hard and do it in the same way every time in a patient. I get a sense of how much I can push on a patient with my index finger alone, and then check the other side, and I agree with you 100% about putting a finger on the muscle that you're testing.
Absolutely. And I don't do things like the OK sign or crossing the fingers. I'm not opposed to them. They just don't necessarily help me.
Yeah, I think they're a little more rudimentary, and we can dial in and be a little more precise with some of the exam maneuvers that we do without taking any more time.
Absolutely. For sensibility, I tend to check two-point knot SEMS. I also check light touch. And in a patient where things seem to be pretty normal, I'll check two-point for the index finger and the small finger. Over the pulp, pushing not too hard. You don't want to test deep pressure. So light touch. I start at 5 millimeters, and if they can discern 5 millimeters, I stop. If they have trouble with 5 millimeters, then I'll increase it. If there's any question, then I'll check all the fingers. And I do like, you know, testing to understand. Let's say the 2-point is 9 millimeters for the index, and it's 5 millimeters for the little finger. I do ask the question more and more if the little finger's a dollar, what type of sensation do you have in the index finger? It does provide a nice little standard for comparison. I think patients like that, and they get it. It's not like I have to spend 5 minutes explaining the question.
Yeah, no, I agree, and it doesn't add a whole lot, and it's just another measure you can use, and things tend to triangulate pretty well. I will say the sensory exam is sometimes where you can pick up some of those subtle things for your differential diagnosis. We know that the median distribution, the lateral cord contribution to the median nerve is what contributes to sensation. So if I'm finding anything off there as well, I then do a very cursory examination of C5 and C6 with deltoid of the biceps, and sometimes you can find some things there. Double crush is pretty common. I mean, cervical spine issues are common. Doesn't mean you need to treat the C-spine. But it is helpful in terms of counseling the patient. Say, hey, there may or may not be something going on in your neck. You're a little weaker on these muscles and your sensation's affected. I think the money's at the carpal tunnel, but, you know, let's start there. Just something to keep in mind.
I totally agree. And then inspection is always important. And really what I'm getting at for inspection in this type of patient is atrophy.
Yeah.
So thenar atrophy, first dorsal interosseous atrophy, just the general appearance of the hand.
Yeah, and patients may not notice it until you point it out. But, you know, the more you look at that convexity of the thenar eminence, if you have them like you're describing, forearms and palms supinated on the table, and you kind of pinch it and get a sense of how robust it is, and you can tell a side-to-side difference in a patient with more advanced findings.
Absolutely. That's probably the basics of my non-provocative maneuvers. I don't know if you want to add anything before I...
No, I think that, the provocative tests are the next in my my line of assessment as well.
Okay. I generally check a cervical range of motion, not to get too much into that for this discussion. Maybe check a Sperling's if there's any doubt, especially if patient reports anything radiating from proximal to distal.
Mm-hmm.
I'll briefly in every patient check for cubital tunnel symptoms. I don't always check for pronator compression level, just because for me it's not a particularly common situation, but I will on occasion check that.
It's because you're not looking.
It may be because I'm not looking.
And it's because it's the Lacertus, not the pronator. I've been brainwashed.
True, or FDS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Agree. But focusing on the carpal tunnel, for me, it is a Tenelle's, So tapping on the median nerve, which I do starting about 2 inches proximal to the carpal tunnel. I hit firmly, but I don't start off hitting super hard, and I go from proximal to distal. For me, I find right at the wrist crease is often the most provocative area. I check both sides and compare them. I perform a wrist flexion compression test with direct pressure with my thumb at the level of the carpal tunnel, actually just proximal to it. And those are the two tests that I really find helpful. I'm sure you do a little bit more than that.
I don't do the standard Phalens as it was described. I think that what you're describing and you know, with compression on the median nerve and some flexion, it'll give you the information that you need. I honestly don't add much more. I'm not a scratch collapser. I have not been able to make that test work in my hands, although I see the utility of it. I also think you can get the same type of information through a very detailed assessment of muscle testing. And then I routinely check for Lacertus proximal median nerve compression in the forearm. And I do that with some pressure adjacent to that flexor pronator fascia, just where it meets the biceps, essentially. And I'll put some pressure in there and see if it reproduces shooting numbness and tingling. I tell the patient it is uncomfortable when I'm going to put my thumb in there. And that's not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for those distally radiating symptoms.
I appreciate that. That's a helpful description. I would counsel that we have to be careful not to over-diagnose proximal compression, because if a patient has a really hot median nerve, they often have irritability at the pronator. During my fellowship, one of my mentors would routinely decompress the proximal median nerve. And I think any symptoms, any irritability led him to perform that surgery. I would say I do it uncommonly, a handful of times a year at most.
For me, it's got to all match. It's got to be what we talked about before with some of the proximally radiating symptoms, a positive provocative test there, and some weakness on the motor examination. If those all add up, then I'll move towards it. You know, I certainly did it more frequently in years past, and I'm now starting to find, I think, the sweet spot on when to do it. But even then, it's helpful just to counsel patients, say, you know, at some point we might need to come back for that.
So Brent Graham is a friend of ours, and he described the CTS6 assessment. But where does that fit? I mean, you can talk bad about it if you don't use it, or if you use the CTS6 as a part of your toolbox in making the carpal tunnel diagnosis, how do you do it?
Well, I mean, I think that we use all the components already, you know, so how we describe taking the history and doing the assessment, we have all the pieces. I don't routinely sit there and tabulate the weighted components of the CTS6. Brent and others have done a fantastic job demonstrating that, you know, this is truly a clinical diagnosis, and CTS6 may indeed supplant the need for nerve studies. I know there are a lot of other surgeons that feel differently, and I think there are some surgeons that get nerve studies for different reasons. And a lot of times patients walk in with nerve studies from somebody else, and you know, we're not, I think most hand surgeons are not using a nerve study to get to the diagnosis. I think we're either doing it to establish severity, and you could argue that there's some reasonable literature saying that severity may not matter. You're still going to get symptom improvement. But I think that's a helpful piece for counseling. I've heard the argument that baseline carpal tunnel studies are helpful if you have recurrence, but those nerve studies never quite normalize down the line. We don't really know what a nerve study is supposed to look like later on. That being said, I get it. If you have a recurrence and you have to reoperate, I guess it's good to have a nerve study to fall back on from before. For me, I use it mainly in my practice to look at severity, to gauge severity. Although, again, you get a lot of that information on the static two-point changes and the muscle atrophy, muscle weakness, but also to exclude additional pathology. If you are looking for C-spine issues, or you know, patients who have carpal and cubital symptoms in my clinic, will typically, I'll get a nerve study and an ultrasound because I want the information. I think the mixture of conditions may muddy the waters a little bit in terms of how you counsel patients.
I think that's perfect, and I think that's how I look at it as well. I also like the CTS6, but don't routinely calculate a score. We are completing a study looking at that and its role in our practice. It'll be really interesting to understand the data once we have it and hopefully publish it. So that's to come soon. The other population for me that almost always gets a nerve study is the workers' compensation patient. Mm-hmm. It's just helpful to have that. It helps justify the surgery to adjusters, and I like that. But in a patient where the diagnosis seems clear, I don't feel the need to get a nerve study in every patient. It's interesting because hand surgeons have been around a while. Remember the AAOS clinical practice guidelines, which at one point said every patient should have a nerve study before surgery, and the more recent version backtracked on that, which I think most of us were happy to see.
Yeah, no, I think that trying to find the right balance of, you know, when to order the test and not, you know, and then also from a personal perspective, I mean, it's not a fun test to have. I've had a nerve study done myself, and it is not comfortable, and patients don't like the experience typically. You know, my patients who I'm sending for nerve studies are also getting an ultrasound. Do you routinely ultrasound your patients?
I do not. I haven't. It's not for me an area of particular research interest, even though I acknowledge that it is likely to be part of our future. So it doesn't help me yet.
I think there's some interesting literature coming out, you know, showing it can be more consistently performed. And, you know, at some point, I'm going to get to the point where I take a course or get some, you know, get my hands onto the machine and just start to measure nerves in a clinic. And not necessarily as a billable kind of thing, but just to have another point of information that I don't need to send somebody else for another test for.
I think it makes sense, and clearly a lot of our colleagues have seen the benefit of it. So maybe I'm late to the party, or maybe I'm not going to go to that party. But for now, just doesn't help me.
So why don't we talk about how you would counsel this patient? 9 months of symptoms, nocturnal spilling into the daytime, what you would try in terms of conservative measures, or whether you would bypass those.
Right. I would, first of all, make sure there's no static changes. So her 2 points okay, her thenar strength is good. So intermittent symptoms during the day and nighttime symptoms. I typically start with a splint. Now, I know she had a splint. Doesn't sound like she wore it, quote unquote, correctly. Correctly for me means nighttime wear. Period. End of story. No daytime wear. And the literature is pretty clear that it will help people. The literature is also pretty clear that if you look at patients a year later, many of them are not still better. And there's some non-surgeon literature which suggested that the majority of patients get better, but that has not been replicated in our literature. So I like it. I don't feel a rush to do the surgery. And some patients like the concept. But when you're honest about what our literature says, I think many people would prefer to go for an answer that's definitive, at least in my practice. But I offer it to everyone.
Yeah, I think that, you know, part of, as surgeons, our approach to this, the lens through we see it, is colored by the fact that we know that we have a very effective treatment that is probably very much on the favorable side of the benefit-risk ratio. So I think that probably influences how we approach these patients. The other thing I'll add is activity modification during the day, you know, so those funny wrist positions that you talked about, trying to see if modifying their yoga practice or backing off on some of the repetitive gripping of the long flexor type activities will help.
I think that's exactly right. I don't, going back to the work comp patient, I don't give them work restrictions or work modifications at all. I just don't go down that path. They work full duty until or unless they decide to go with surgery.
What do you make of the of keyboarding and carpal tunnel? And I know that was a big focus in the 90s.
Yeah, well, God, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. I think that...
And Brad Evanoff has a podcast.
He does, a really good one.
And about that in particular.
Yeah. You know, the newest clinical practice guidelines cite several articles which suggest that a high repetition keyboarding can indeed lead to carpal tunnel syndrome or be seen with greater prevalence in patients. I still think the body of our literature doesn't really support that. I'm a believer for the work patient in high force, high repetition, cold environment, wrist motion more than finger activities like typing.
Every now and then, I'll have some kind of patient, work comp or not, that just has awful posture. They're behind a desk all day, and they just need an ergonomic assessment. And our hand therapy colleagues are great at providing that service for patients, either in the hand therapy clinic or, in some cases, going to the patient's workspace. And I think it doesn't come up very often for me, but I think that's something to keep in mind. And especially if you're, you know, counseling friends and family about carpal tunnel and you know what they do for a living, there's probably some adjustments they can make. Same thing for cubital tunnel, too.
That's exactly right. And we live in a funny state for work comp because Missouri is a very different threshold for calling something carpal tunnel compared to Illinois. So we're kind of sitting in a straddle area, which makes conversations, you know, more difficult. For this patient, you know, I'd offer the night splint. If she wanted to consider an injection either now or, you know, 6 weeks from now, I would offer her that. But really what I say is try a splint. You know where to find me. I don't set up a follow-up visit. I say if this doesn't provide the long-lasting relief that you seek, you can come back and we can talk more. You can come back and try a steroid injection. and you can either come back or call if you'd like to schedule surgery.
Yeah, I'm very similar, and I tell them the same things that you described in terms of kind of the warning things to look for. And I don't offer that that type of treatment if they've got anything that tips us off to more severe pathology. So like you're saying, you know, muscle weakness, static two-point changes, and even persistent daytime symptoms. But, you know, like you intimated, those patients are going to come back anyway.
Right. Are there any patients, to be very specific to what you just said, are there any patients that you say you should have surgery?
I tell them, you know, if I see that they have atrophy on my exam and that their 2 points are, you know, essentially off the charts, I tell them this is not going to get any better. And my goal is honestly just to stop this from getting worse. And I tell them you should have this done sooner rather than later. And, I, you know, I think in my practice, I've noticed I probably have a lower threshold to offer surgery when I do it under a local anesthetic, just because it takes, you know, one part of the equation out of it for a lot of patients. That type of presentation is typically in an older patient, and their trepidation about having some kind of sedation or anesthesia is a lot of times what holds them back from surgery, at least from what I've noticed.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right. And I think the honest conversation where we take the time to explain the pros and cons of surgery really is helpful for patients. And what you said earlier is right on the money. We believe in the surgery because this is one of my favorite surgeries to do. Because it really is an effective surgery with just high rates of happy patients.
Indeed. And like we said earlier, if you catch them in a sweet spot, the patient who's got nocturnal symptoms, they come back at that first post-op visit. They hug you because they haven't slept like that in months or years.
That's exactly right. Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is @congenitalhand. What about you?
Mine is @ChrisDMD, spelled D-Y. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand and come back next time.